Okay, so Terry has a hand up. Owen does. I want to hear from Pat on this because you must have something to say about this. And if you haven't, Paul has something on this. Guven, and we'll just work through that little group there. Terry.
So recidivism, there is a well tried and a working method for reducing recidivism of violent criminals, and has a very firm biological basis. It's called caning. It's well known that if you take a criminal who comes in for the first time and use literally a cane to break the skin on the back under the conditions where the prisoner actually passes out, that the probability of going back and doing a violent crime is very, very small. Take one of your 90% recidivists, reduce them to somewhere up, less than a few percent. But that's not done. It is done in some societies. It's not done here because it's considered barbaric. But here's the trade-off, okay? Here's somebody who very likely will go out, commit a crime, come back, and basically the entire life is going to be in prison, going recycling between prison and society and doing violence in society. Or you can do something which goes directly to the brain, hardwiring in a pattern that they're not going to repeat again. They're not going to go back and do that because they know what they're going to get, and they have a life. In Singapore, this is part of their way of keeping criminals outside, and as a consequence, they have the lowest recidivism rate of any nation in the world. So, what's your comment on that? Here's a case where we actually have a biological solution to a problem.
It's a difficult puzzle why we don't do something like that, in the sense that you could imagine the offender that you mentioned volunteering for such treatment, right? Because it would make his life better in the long run. And I don't have a good answer for you, but I also think it's worth pointing out that the answers that people are likely to give will point to things like you said, it's barbaric and that sort of thing. But at the same time, we tend to fail to recognize the barbaric aspects of the punishments that we do use, such as imprisonment. So, there's a prisoner I read, he said, I would cut off my arm if I could hug my mother again, right? That suggests there's something barbaric about confining someone in prison for a person's whole life. So I don't have an answer to the puzzle except to add elements to it.
The only thing I would add is that that type of punishment sometimes, I don't know about Singapore, but in some societies, sends the message that that's an appropriate way to treat people
right.
who you think have done something wrong. And it might be then authorizing individuals to use such methods themselves, whereas most people don't have jail cells that they can lock people up. So, but they do have canes, and they can administer that. So there might be side effects on the other people in society, even if it's more effective in preventing recidivism. Now, whether any of that's true is something that we need to find out, and then society needs to make a decision. But there are a lot of complications.
Amanda, I do now think that law might be intellectually respectable. Thank you. It's a question for everybody, I think. And it's about the intellectual division of labor. So there's this question about the relationship between science, information, public policy, and the law, and how it gets there. So Nita's point about trying to get people to talk on behalf of the amicus brief about genetics and criminality, and scientists not being able to speak. And then Amanda, your point about phrenology. So there's issues about bad science. There's issues about scientists not being vocal enough where they have the expertise. Then there's other issues about immature science. So I take it that in some ways what Adam was talking about was how you'd move forward in talking about these subjective issues. And then Walter, of course, was talking about immature science because he teased us with, here's what we could do, but now I take it all back because we can't do it yet. So phrenology is bad science, and then there's, and then Aaron, of course, at the end with the neuroeconomics game, like basing deregulation on some games that are being played in the last 10 years is dangerous stuff. So then meanwhile, there's the what I call the neuroeconomists. I mean, the neurojournalists. They're the people who are watching where everything's happening, and they immediately splash it on the pages, and then people get enthusiastic and apply it. So it's a huge, I see this as a huge public policy problem, and one of them is going on, like it was mentioned yesterday, Roger mentioned, trolleyology. Every philosopher who studies moral philosophy knows that trolley problems are so ecologically invalid, it's like insane, but that's what all the data are being gathered on now. So so I'm just concerned about if anybody has any ideas about how to how this is supposed to work out in terms of how information is passed among disciplines. And I thought some interesting ideas came up yesterday from Cheryl and Chris, so maybe they want to chime in, but I'm just concerned about, I'm more concerned rather than less concerned about how the intellectual division of labor works or how it could be suggested to work effectively.
I think you're raising excellent points, and law is an extremely large and diverse not only body of information but set of institutions. And then evidence is used differently in each of those types of institutions. So we have legislatures that can support fact-finding, we have courts that hear experts, we have administrative agencies that may or may not have budget to do their own kinds of inquiries. Each one of those institutions is working with different evidentiary constraints and different goals, and a defense attorney and a prosecutor have very different concerns in what type of evidence they ought to be allowed to use. I think that your question goes to the central issue of error costs. If we can be aware of an error rate in a particular technology, where are we more concerned about making error costs, assuming we also know the rates of type 1 and type 2 errors? So we might have a higher concern in a courtroom or a plea bargaining context where a person's liberty interest is at stake, and we might have a lower concern about error costs if you are trying to govern hiring practices for a daycare center or for your nanny, where you might not care that much about false positives. You just want to make sure that you can bring everything you can to bear. And I think that where those error costs are set are going to vary in each one of those legal contexts. So, for example, it's not that uncommon that some types of evidence, and Nita will be able to speak more to this, can be admitted by the defense but not by the prosecution. That's one of the things that makes this Indian case so troubling. It was the prosecution that was allowed to introduce that evidence. But the ways in which there is actually no sort of central valve or central control that would pass on the acceptability of evidence across these different domains, legislative, administrative, and courtroom.
I think, too, in addition to thinking about procedural protections that can limit the use of science that's not ready for public policymaking, I do think, in general, I think we need less division of labor rather than more, in the sense that advocates who have a cause are going to use whatever the scientists produce if they think it will further their cause. And that's going to happen no matter what we say, and we can try to confine it a little bit, but it's a reality of the world. And so from the law perspective, we used to sit in our offices. We didn't have to figure out how to get grants. We could just sit in our offices, sit back, wait for the scientists to, do their work, and then jump in with potential policy implications. But I think there's a growing realization in the legal academy that one vital role they could play is to actually step in. Being in the academy, it's an opportunity to step in and team up with the scientists to try to get the science moved further along, so that to the extent what was premature was cause harmful results in the policymaking world, we could come to something that's less that's more mature more quickly, and that's relevant for law. And I think Nate is exactly right on the science side. I think the scientists have to be less reluctant to come to the table when courts or legislatures are considering issues, to say, we just don't think this is a good time. We need more, or we need something different.
Nita. Yeah.
So I take your question maybe a little bit differently than Aaron or Amanda did, which is not just a division of labor within the legal community, but also a division of labor between scientists, policymakers, legal community, philosophers, et cetera. Who bears the burden of dealing with these issues? And you know, my talk focuses on the scientist in part because I think that they're not participating as much. That isn't to suggest that the burden is entirely on the scientists, right? So I think that the legal community, as Aaron says, will seize upon any kind of science, and advocates will seize upon any kind of science to forward their cause as quickly as possible. I think as scientists, that puts a greater burden then to actually have to say and to be vocal about the limitations in the science, the limitations in the applications, and the limitations in the uses that are being touted. And I also think that there is an ethical burden on scientists for the potential uses and applications. So as scientists who, you know, their livelihood depends on accepting grants, people, I think, are, in, particularly in academia, give them sort of a free ride and say, well, it's okay, you know, they depend on grants, and so therefore it should, they shouldn't have to refuse grants if it has some potential application in the future. I think scientists actually should consider what the application and use is of the science that's being developed, to consider whether or not they're comfortable with the direction of the research and the direction of the application of the research before they accept the grant money and accept that kind of research grant money and develop the science, unless they're also willing to engage in the dialogue and engage in the ethical debate.
Yeah, well, first, thank you all for some really fascinating talks. I found this session remarkably useful. There's one thing that disturbs me, though, that was coming out implicitly in many of your presentations. It seems that we're taking refuge in the current incompleteness of the science. I think we should all be quite frightened of the premature application of this science, and we should all be retrospectively embarrassed by the history of polygraphy and certainly phrenology. So we should be very sober about how immature the science is. But it seems to me that there's a philosophically suspect notion of free will and a suspect notion of blameworthiness being eroded by a real understanding of causality at work here. It came out a little bit in Walter's talk. At one point he said, when contemplating giving long sentences to people, we have to bear in mind possible exculpatory causes like child abuse or genes. Well, that's everything. You know, that's nature and nurture. You know, what isn't possibly exculpatory if you understand the causes? And in Amanda's talk, she was loath to ascribe violent behavior to neurological disorder, and that's certainly a valid point to make given the state of the science, but at some level all behavior can be ascribed to a brain state. I mean, it must be so. You know, the fact that I don't understand string theory could be described as a neurological disorder, you know, presumably one that my friend Lawrence Krauss doesn't have. Now we can't scan our brains and figure out which of us understands string theory, but in principle, at some point, we will be able to look at our brains in real time in response to being pummeled with equations, and we'll know who is lying about being a physicist. So we have to deal, and I think Adam's presentation focusing on blameworthiness is useful to focus on, because it really does come down to this issue of, if we understand the causes of human behavior much more deeply than we do at present, does our ethical notion of right and wrong evaporate? And I think it does not at all. It's just there's a strand of judgmentalism that will get stripped out. You know, we don't judge grizzly bears for attacking people whenever they get the chance. And we would lock up grizzly bears if they were wandering our streets. We need not judge psychopaths for recidivating at the rate they do. But once we understand psychopathy and we understand its genetic component and everything else, we'll be able to take steps to protect ourselves. And I just think there's a comment for all of you.
Since you referred to me, I just want to clarify. I wasn't endorsing that fairness objection. I actually, you know, think that objection can be answered. Because I'm a compatibilist, and I think that even if those causes do determine our actions, we still might be free and we still are in many cases free and responsible My point was that when a society decides what to do with this group of people, they have to take that kind of objection seriously because it's so common, and it shouldn't just be disregarded. But I agree with you that it's not going to undermine responsibility, and that, you know, in my view at least, in the end, it would be fair to give these people longer sentences, either because they've done something in advance or because it's going to be necessary to protect other innocent people, even if they are innocent, but innocent people in the future.
I'm going to pick up on that. Walter and I actually had a debate about this just a few weeks ago at another conference about your very point. And that claim is a claim that I call behavioral morality, the idea that causes of, you know, anything that can be described, the causes of human behavior, is excusing or either negates responsibility or culpability. And we disagree a little bit, Walter and I, on what ultimately that would mean, I think. I agree with you that I don't think it would negate responsibility. There are plenty of reasons, whether compatibilist reasons or other normative justifications for the criminal justice system outside of ones that we may have raised here today, that simply describing the causes of human behavior wouldn't solve, right? So if we can describe every reason why we act the way we do, that wouldn't eliminate the need for a criminal justice system. We would still have other normative reasons why we'd want to protect society, why we would want to enforce norms, why we'd want to create norms and aspirational goals for human behavior. And yet, the question still remains, what are you ultimately going to do with this science, right? It may change what we think the right answers are about, you know, to Adam's point about what the right punishment model is. And that's one of the ways in which Walter and I disagree, is what the ultimate response by society should be. So it may be that we hold people responsible, but to what degree, to what extent, and what's the ultimate response to each individual?
Can I just say things? There's three things I want you to think about, then we'll go to a couple of these other places. But I do want to come back to this notion of whether scientists should have to be amateur consequentialist philosophers before they accept an R01. I do want to talk to you about scientists and their relationship with judges and talking to judges, which is the point you made the other day. And you used a big R word, which is regulation, in context of trust. And I think there's a larger context in which the whole regulation issue is something. So can I just remind you that we need to think about those and talk about those before we go to Pat Chosen?
I just wanted to pick up on Anita's talk, which I found really fascinating. And I do suspect, however loath I am to do it, that one of the reasons that scientists are not coming forward is money. And that is that something that we have seen over the last 40 years is that scientists like to make companies for themselves and flog their discoveries as technological devices in their companies. Now, to a first approximation, that's fine. And it's great that these new devices get out in the market and so forth. But this also has a very clear opportunity for conflict of interest. And there are scientists who are claiming extraordinary things for their technological devices in order to hype their companies so that their companies will make them rich and perhaps go public. We saw yesterday on the front page of the New York Times a description of Charles Nemiroff, who is a psychiatrist and researcher on drugs, who's been on the take from pharmacological companies now for years. Now, I don't want to sound like a Puritan and say that, you know, scientists shouldn't be making money. On the other hand, I think you did point out that they have a special obligation, and I do agree with that. And part of the reason, I think, is that we do live extraordinarily privileged lives in science. We are protected in all kinds of ways from the uncertainty of the economy. We get to do what we want and what we like, and it's enormously great fun. And I have to say that well, maybe these are puritanical hackles, but they do get raised when scientists have companies using devices that and they make all kinds of claims for those devices in order to sell them, and the claims are manifestly exaggerations. Oof, that was my rant.
So I just want to clarify, your objection is not, I take it, to scientists having companies. It's to scientists exaggerating claims and, in effect, lying in order to fill their pockets.
Well, it is a temptation to do that, or to be invited on a board for a company where you may not be paid vast amounts of money, but you know you're paid enough so that you could get that trip to Bermuda or whatever it happens to be. And I just think it's terribly dangerous. And I do see certain scientists, and of course Nemiroff is the really sterling example here, who basically sell their souls. And I think it's absolutely ghastly.
Well, my old torts professor and the great judge Guido Calabresi said, when people have an interest at stake, it's not that they lie, they just become confused.
Phil Zimbardo.
I guess I wanted to say that we all share the same vision of understanding complex human behavior. And partly we do it for intellectual curiosity, but we also do it because we're optimists. We want to change undesirable behavior, we want to improve the human condition. And I guess what I have to add as a social psychologist is that we tend to underestimate the importance of the individual in the situation and the situation in a system. So, for example, if we want to understand part of criminal behavior is the parole board. I was part of a class action suit in California, and I got to sit in on parole board hearings. They're the most atrocious things imaginable. You're a prisoner, you have 1 year, you're going to present your case. You never have more than 5 minutes. On average, the parole board hearing is 5 minutes. There's two parole officers. While one is questioning you, the other one is reading the papers of the next prisoner. And the key to whether you get a parole or not is the opening question. If they ask you about the crime, if they ask you about any problem you've had in prison, you never get parole. If they ask you, what are you doing to get out, what treatment are you in, what therapy you're in, and it's just random. And as they're going through, they'll stop. And so here's this situation, and you can imagine being a prisoner. I mean, obviously I'm identified. That is, you know, you did all the things you thought, and if they ask this question and didn't ask you, what are you doing to get out? Are you in therapy? Then no matter what you say, you're not going to get out. And so that whole situation is terrible. The system, tying to Aaron's point, is, you know, we all agree on pedophilia is bad, except when we have more than 200 Catholic priests who've been covered by the Catholic Church. Not a single priest has gone to trial. The church is willing to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to cover over. And I think the same thing in studying Abu Ghraib, the system protects all the officers. Not a single officer went to trial for the abuses at Abu Ghraib that went on for 3 months. And command complicity is if your subordinates engage in immoral, illegal behavior that you should have known about, you are equally culpable. And not a single officer went to trial. And so here's how systems create, maintain situations, and our behavior is influenced by those situations. So I just want to throw that in as a social psychologist banner.
Yeah, I think Christopher Hitchens described that as leave no childs behind, as I recall.
Oof.
Since he couldn't make it. Anthony Grayling.
Yeah, just to comment on the contrast that some might think they see between, on the one hand, the incomplete or the in-progress nature of a lot of this work that you've been very, very interestingly talking about, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the maturity of some of our thinking about civil liberties and human rights. And I mean, what lies in the background of some of your anxieties is precisely that the applications of these advances are already impinging in a very negative way on our civil liberties regimes. And there are two thoughts there. One is that that there is a tendency always for people to think that because we can do something, we should do something. If we are able to, you know, map regions of the brain that might be indicative of psychopathy, then we should make use of them and we should judge people on the basis of those sorts of results. So because we can do it, we should do it. And some of our thinking about civil liberties, of course, goes directly against that. It doesn't follow from the fact that you have a capacity that you are entitled to apply it. That's one thing. But the other thing is that some of this work might actually challenge the assumptions on which our civil liberties thinking is based. I mean, it may very well be that there are some important findings that will come out of this that tell us that we were just wrong to think what we do about human nature on the basis of which we think that certain things like privacy and freedom of speech and, you know, all those other civil liberties considerations are founded. And so I wonder what your feeling is about this, because one thing that competent judges of the state of a scientific area should be doing when they do get involved in discussions about public policy implications is to take into account those civil liberties and human rights and ethical consequences, just as Nita said, but to do it in a way which is very sensitive to those two considerations. Either we're really, really just running ahead of ourselves without thinking about the consequences, or fundamentally we're discovering something that we need to understand in order to revise our thinking about the ethical and the civil liberty side of things.
Can I start with this one? So I want to answer your question in two parts. The first is on the criminal law side, and second is on the military side. So I think you're right that part of what's animating my concerns, at least, is the concerns about civil liberties, and not just civil liberties, but concepts of personhood and privacy that this kind of information is already butting up against. In the criminal law context, you know, we're already facing some of that, and it does call into question issues about First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment. You know, what is a search when you discard DNA, when you, you know, throw a cup away and it has your saliva on it? Is it okay to take your DNA away from it? Under the Fifth Amendment, you know, if we're able to pick up brain information from you, is that self-incrimination if we use that against you in court? Or is the Fifth Amendment really about, for the self-incrimination clause, is it really about reliability of evidence, right? And if it's about reliability of evidence and we're able to have more reliable information from neuroscience, does it mean that we no longer think about the self-incrimination clause in the same way that we did before? And so it's pushing the boundaries of what we think about civil liberties within that context. On the military side, it's a little bit scarier, though, right? There aren't the same civil liberty protections in that context. And so limiting the application and the development of the neuroscience isn't happening on that side. In the National Research Council report, they say things like, you know, a good application of this technology would be at ports where constitutional protections don't apply. And it would be, you know, against terrorists in other countries who don't have the constitutional protections. And so a good way to push the boundary in the development of the science is by using it against individuals who don't have the constitutional protections and the civil liberty protections that we have in this country. And so it's allowing a more rapid and unchecked development of this technology, which then, of course, will end up in civilian applications and uses before we've even had an opportunity to consider the application and consideration of those technologies.
I think another important thing to think about when we think about these new technologies is how they lead us to question our old technologies. Here's the most important thing in my mind about when brain lie detection is going to be ready is, when does brain lie detection plus jury give us better result than just jury alone? And so it's very hard to compare lie detection versus jury. Why? Because we don't know how good a jury is. We don't know the error rates of a jury. So how are we supposed to compare this new technology where we actually might be able to develop some numbers to a technology that's much, much older, but we have a very poor sense of how good it is? So I think that thinking about the new technology should lead us to question the old. So, for example, Philip mentioned parole boards, right? I think if I talk about measuring subjective experience, people would think, how are we possibly going to do this on an ongoing basis? Very difficult. But yet parole boards are supposed to measure dangerousness, and of course offenders have incentives to lie about that, but it follows a kind of inertia path. So we're used to parole boards, and so we don't question it. It doesn't seem shocking to us, whereas the idea that a parole board might think about how a person's experienced their punishment seems, you know, crazy.
Also, I think your question about what if this makes us think about our civil liberties extremely differently may have in it, and correct me, Anthony, if I'm not understanding your question right, may be raising the question of what if these technologies point to the conclusion that folk psychology is radically false and we should be taking an extremely different approach to the mind. And that ties into Sam's question of what happens once we can no longer caveat these statements by saying that the science is too early, too preliminary, to avoid the central question of free will and responsibility, and then how do we deal with punishment or even notions of credit and blame more generally in society if free will turns out to be false? Well, Sam may have a brain limitation preventing him from understanding string theory. I know that I have a limitation that's going to prevent me personally from solving the free will problem, although there may be those in the audience who will achieve that task. But perhaps even when the science is at a stage of greater development such that we have better predictive accuracy and when we can determine the degrees of individual choice that we have, there will still be issues for the law to solve that don't entirely collapse into the scientific issues around what we mean when we say something is brain-based and what we mean when we say it's a disorder. Certainly all behavior emerges from the brain, but if one person can play violin because they've had lessons and the other person can't play violin because they have not, those differences are reflected in their brain, but the inability to play violin in the second person is not a brain disorder. And so what we determine to be a disorder or not, and what we determine to be the individual's responsibility or not, still fundamentally turns on normative and social considerations that are not entirely inside the individual brain.
If I can also add, you know, one of the things that we need to think about too is how science, even in its infancy, can be used effectively in some contexts and not others. It's even the same piece of science, and I want to just throw out, you know, one is kind of a distinction between when science is used defensively and when it's used offensively. So, for example, you know, work on the juvenile brain, you know, indicates that teenagers have less prefrontal lobe development and that as a consequence of that, lots of behaviors are affected, like impulsiveness and peer pressure and failure to exercise good judgment, whatever. I mean, as a parent of a teenager, I can tell you we knew that. It was obvious. We didn't need the brain science for it. But when you start talking about juvenile justice and you take that issue into the political arena, there's enormous pressure on the part of legislatures to do away with the juvenile justice system because that seems to be like coddling criminals who do us a lot of harm out there in the world. And so the political pressures are really strong to move the train in a particular direction. There's a situation where you've got science, it may be in its infancy, it may not tell us specifically what to do about an individual juvenile justice situation, but it may be that that it's enough that's there, and maybe because it's also, you know, sort of buttressing an intuition that we have, those of us who are parents of teens, about teens anyway, that it can at least maybe be used to slow the train so that we can think about hard about the question of whether our desire to treat juveniles as adults is a consequence of something informed or is a consequence of just pure politics to look like we're responding to public safety issues.
Gouven, you have something?
This is a question for the whole panel, although it was inspired by Adam's and Walter's talks. So a possibility that came out of your talks is perhaps transforming the sentencing guidelines and regulations on the basis of individual differences, right? Similar circumstances, similar crime, person A happens to be more dangerous, and this was in Walter's talk, and we determined this through neuroscience, perhaps a longer sentence. Or person B seems to be suffering from claustrophobia, or the subjective experience is more intense, so a shorter sentence. It seems that there are two different issues. One is about deterrence, the other is about perhaps justice on the basis of subjective experience and so forth. But, and it looks like there are enormous difficulties, no doubt. You know, what if the claustrophobic person becomes non-claustrophobic within the first 6 months of their sentence and learns how to meditate and enjoying his or her experience and so forth. My question, though, is so these pragmatic difficulties aside, from an ethical point of view and also from a legal point of view, do you endorse this possibility, this kind of a transformation in the legal system? And that I ask to everyone in the panel.
There are some kinds of transformation that I endorse and not others. So I would have to get a lot more specific whether I knew to endorse it. It seems to me that, you know, take retributivism as a theory. There's a minimal version that you shouldn't be punishing people who are innocent. That I don't want to change. But when somebody says, you know, you have to have the punishment fit the crime,
I'm not even sure exactly what that means, because when it gets specific, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, no, I don't think we ought to be poking out eyes. And so I want to transform a lot of the, you know, processes that we have now that are built on outmoded intuitions, and try to modify the system so as to serve its purpose, which I take is mainly to reduce crime and to reduce crime while still avoiding the kinds of injustice that would happen if we started jailing innocent people. So there are going to be limits, but then, yes, then we ought to be using the tools of science to structure the system in such a way as to make our society better.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it depends on the particular circumstances involved. My main point certainly was that we need to think about these things and measure these things, because whether you're a attributivist or a consequentialist, subjective experience matters. And I frame it that way on purpose because, you know, there's a hundreds-of-year-old debate that sort of tries to work out these two issues, and to the extent that you can say something that applies to both, I think you make some progress. The details about how to implement it, I think, are going to depend on which theory one takes, and I think that, so it will depend on the theory, but generally speaking, if there are certain goals that we're trying to achieve, if you try to be consequentialist about it, then to the extent that you can bring the costs down of making your sentencing more individualized, then you can make it more practical to sentence in an individual way to better accomplish one's goals.
Yeah, quickly.
So quickly, I'll say I take a more objective approach to criminal law and think that there are reasons why the system exists the way it does. On responsibility theory, I don't think that neuroscience or behavioral genetics is going to change very much of what we think about why we hold people responsible for what they do. On the punishment side, it's, I think, an empirical question. So if neuroscience or behavioral genetics can show us more effective ways to achieve the outcomes that we're seeking to achieve, like general welfare, norm enforcement, and aspirational goals, then yes, I think neuroscience and behavioral genetics can be quite effective, and I would welcome it. Its use at a more general policy level to transform the system, not, I don't think, at an individual level like Adam proposes, though.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with Nita. I think, though, that one of the things we need to think about on a general policy level is individual subjective experiences to punishment, not because I buy into the notion that it really matters that we equalize their subjective experiences, but because there's mounting evidence that one cause of recidivism is that some individuals in prison actually find that they survive there much more effectively, that that's their cohort, that they can get along with, that they've got 3 square meals a day, that they've got rules that they understand, that they've got a social situation that they know how to navigate, and it's much less complicated to them than it is out there in the real world. And to the extent that that kind of subjective experience is contributing to recidivism, I think we really do need to address that as a policy matter at an individual level, perhaps.
Very complicated, isn't
yeah.
it? Briefly, Amanda.
Yes, just to take the punishment question, the neurology of punishment, beyond the person who's being punished, there seems to be a taste for punishment amongst the community, pleasure that we derive from punishing others and in considering how punishment may or should be modified based on what we're learning about the neurobiology of offenders. We need to take into account the extent to which we could ever effectuate that given the preferences for punishment that non-offenders, community members, may have.
Although we kind of gave up on the hang drawing and quartering, so I suppose that's a slight improvement. There were two left, you with her, and then Steve after that. He's going to give you the mic. So.
Hi.
Is this?
And we fairly quickly. We've run late, but
do something to get this to. Is it okay? I just want to bring up quickly again, caning in the context of cruelty. Seems to me like there's good reasons that I won't go through in the interest of time. Good reasons for thinking that caning could be one of the most humanitarian practices that we could introduce, and I feel like it's a real shame that there isn't a whole lot more serious discussion of that option for the kinds of reasons that Terry alluded to. And I think a couple of people up there mentioned that there's, you know, much, much less recidivism. It seems like in some ways it could be a lot less cruel than lots of things that happen in prison. including spending your whole life there, just the sheer fact of that. And so I want to bring this up in the context of something Amanda said about norms informing what counts as violence. Like, so domestic violence, now we consider that violence, but we didn't used to. I think we should realize that what we think of as cruelty is equally susceptible, and we should allow for, I want to say two things. One, if we have the plasticity and the flexibility to think of caning as not being cruel, given the humanitarian purposes that we would be using it for. And alternatively, I think we should call into question, with a lot of respect for Sam, the idea that cruelty is wrong in the first place. I don't think that's universally agreed upon. One of my favorite philosophers, Nietzsche, is pretty infamous for calling that into question. It's not obvious to me that cruelty is wrong, and I think that one of the explanations that we don't take caning more seriously is that, A, we're convinced that it's cruel, and B, we're convinced that cruelty is wrong. And I think both of those things could be called into question, you know. Yeah, I'll leave it there.
I think that, well, first, even if Terry's right about the caning finding, it doesn't mean that caning is the best way of accomplishing it. So I feel like we didn't give you a really good answer before, and I think Walter brought up a good response about this view that it could create, you know, encourage other kinds of bad affect. And again, there might be better ways of doing it. So psychologists do find that there's this aspect of celerity, how closely we connect the punishment to the bad act, and we tend to do a bad job of that with imprisonment because there's a long delay. But again, we might be able to shorten that time and not necessarily use the punishment of caning. There might be other options. So I think that there's so much revulsion to caning that it doesn't seem like a promising approach, but there might be something else that's better that also accomplishes a better deterrence.
I want to agree with your first comment, though, that we ought to talk and think about these things seriously instead of just dismissing them at the beginning. I mean, I find, you know, in some audiences, you know, somebody says something like that, they go, oh, that's just inhumane, that's horrible, how dare you say such a thing? You know, we've got to get beyond that if we're going to find a way out of the mess that we're in with regard to criminal justice.
Okay, I'll try to be really brief. I'm a little worried that by putting so much focus on questions of adjudication and sentencing rather than on what happens afterward, it may be a bit like measuring with a micrometer and cutting with a very dull axe, because if you think about, for example, subjective balancing of severity of sentences, we know already that in our current prison system, people in the same prison have very diverse experiences depending on whether they're being raped, whether they're on the dominant part of the pecking order, what gang they belong to, and so on. And the idea that the prison is some sort of a pristine, controlled environment, like a really good study hall, you know, is a pretty wrong thing. You know, there's a symbiotic relationship between guards and gangs and all this stuff going on. And so if people, you know, the public may have a taste for that in some sense, but it's interesting that for some people, in fact, probably going to prison isn't that bad a deal because they're at the top of the pecking order. Okay. So a lot of those kinds of problems seems sort of silly to be worrying about small differences in how long people are sentenced. In terms of the technological possibilities of future things, it seems to me that any kind of brain technology is going to fall well behind our technologies for monitoring and recording everything that happens around a person. And so it's going to be not very far away in the future when it's going to be possible to offer people the option of release from prison early, but they're going to have stuff around them so that we will know every single thing that happens to them, a black box, basically. I think that seems to me that's happening a lot faster than any of these other neural things. So anyway,
no,
I just wondered.
I agree with that. I mean, the use of ankle bracelets with GPS devices on them certainly acts as a reminder that you're very likely to get caught if you go around committing crimes. And so there are various things that we can do now that ought to be considered in addition. I don't think that, you know, undermines the need for the neuroscience research as well, but also simple things, even without technology. You know, you want to cut the recidivism rate. One thing is help these prisoners when they get out of prison. Instead of just throwing them out on the street with no place to go and nothing to do, there are lots of steps we can take. I take those to be complementary, not exclusive.
One last thing, I think you generally supported my view, which is not just that we could adjust sentences. There's lots of other ways of adjusting severity, so I agree with all that. But you brought up the caning again, right? We do. Sorry. Oh, okay. Just when you, sorry, you mentioned prison rape, and so the point that I wanted to make there was we don't do offenders any bonus if, rather than, you know, caning them at the beginning, they then end up in prison, and 2 years later somebody canes them in prison. So that was the connection to your comment.
That was a wonderful session. Thank the panel. Thank you.